This is Storage Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
This is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast. I'm at Flash Memory Summit still at Flash Memory Summit, day three. And I'm with Andy Watson from Worker.io. Hi, Andy.
Hello, Chris.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. It's been a great conference, and I'm happy to say that we've gotten a lot of attention, and I've actually had an opportunity to speak at the conference on the first day, the second day, and on this third day, I will be speaking three times.
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah, so it's good visibility for us.
Good, and I don't know about you, but my voice is starting to go a little bit. I can hear it. So if anybody's thinking it doesn't quite sound like me, it's because I think it's just a bit dry, you know. But there you go. It is what it is.
Yeah, we'll soldier on.
Absolutely. Just for a bit of background, could you provide a bit of context for what you do within the company, what the company does? And I think that will help to understand, as we go into our discussion, how you sort of appear as an expert in this discussion.
Oh, okay. I'm the CTO. I joined the company in October. The company's been in business for about 5 years, and the software has been generally available, GA, as they say, since sometime in early 2018, although there have been some brave customers using it since 2017, which was very helpful to the process of making it
Absolutely.
GA quality.
Yeah.
So it's not completely new in that sense, although there is a much broader community of customers using it today than a year ago or 2 years ago. And the exciting thing about it, from my perspective, having been involved with file storage, dedicated file servers going all the way back, I must say, makes me feel old to say so, all the way back to AUSPEX, which was the first dedicated file server, network attached file server, in the early 90s. And then after that, I had a very good run with Network Appliance, where I was the second CTO. I was there for 12 years from 95 to 2007.
And the fact that you call it Network Appliance and not Netter.
Yeah, well, it was Network Appliance. And then at some point, the name changed, although, you know, our shorthand for it had been NetApp all along.
Yep.
In any case, long story short, I've been involved with this sort of thing for quite a while, done a few things along the way since NetApp, and now here I am. The interesting thing about what we're doing now is if you look at the opportunity that you have for very low latency access to data, ordinarily you end up using something like block storage because that is where you get hardware level latencies, sub millisecond and so forth, and that's all fine. In fact, it can be quite exciting. However, you add a file system on top of it, and that makes it much slower, right?
Absolutely,
the file system average response time, even a very good one, might be adding another 10 milliseconds, right? And so there you go. You were at half a millisecond, and now you're at over 10 milliseconds.
And nowadays, 10 milliseconds is a huge, huge number to be talking about compared to what we used to see.
Right. It can feel punishing.
Yeah.
However, what we do that's fundamentally different changes the game for many of these workloads that we've become essential to, and the word's getting out and it is creating some hypergrowth excitement for us, is that we have written software, because we're a software-defined solution that you run on commodity hardware of your choice, is we do that block-level integration with the hardware. So that's part of our software stack. And we do implement our own NVMe fabric. So we're providing that part of the solution as well. However, we've also integrated the file system. So we don't provide just the block layer and then you add a file system that slows things down. We're also delivering the file system with the POSIX semantics and the fully distributed metadata, so it also scales linearly out to as large as you really want to go. We've built a cluster and tested it out to 4,096 nodes so that we could officially test it and support
it. Actually done it, yes.
But it goes much larger than that, in fact. So it's scalable, linearly scaling in terms of performance, and you're getting sub-millisecond response times because it's flash native. In fact, our software doesn't even work with hard disks.
Yeah, okay. So I'll just, for the record, I'll say that in the show notes, I'll put a couple of links in. One to a recent blog post I wrote, which actually came out of the Tech Field Day discussion where you were presenting.
Oh, yes, I remember now.
I was there, yeah, that's right. And then a previous podcast we've done with Liren, where we actually went into the technical detail in a lot more depth, which obviously is not what we're going to do today, but that will allow people to go off and find that background. So that will be in the show notes as we normally do. Now, really what we wanted to focus on was just have a little discussion about where we see things going in terms of the industry, because from an acquisitions perspective, it's been very interesting to see Elastifile being acquired recently. We've seen E8 being acquired, and they clearly have been bought because they fit into the requirements of those cloud providers. And I'd like to get your opinion about what you think the basis for that is.
You know, I don't mean to be unkind. Mm-hmm. Their technology was interesting, and in fact, in some areas, it was superb.
Mm-hmm. But who are we talking about there?
Both of them,
both
actually.
Both of them? Okay.
Both Elastifile and E8. However, they were not acquired so much for the fit between what they provided and what the acquiring company needed.
Yeah.
It was really a rescue, right? Those companies had both failed to raise money, and they weren't able to sustain themselves from revenue, and so they were increasingly desperate. And so neither one of them had a very good outcome. They weren't paid very much in those acquisitions. So the details of the acquisition price paid was not disclosed publicly, but there's a lot of information floating about the approximate amounts paid.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything about the Elastifile one, but I've seen something about E8. Yeah. And it was only a multiple of maybe 2.5, 3 to 1 maybe, I think, from what I saw.
Yeah, if that. And so therefore, there's nothing to celebrate. However, there is obviously some intellectual property, and AWS did capture all at once an integrated team of very smart people.
Absolutely.
So that's good for them. But it wasn't as if AWS was out looking somewhere we need to find this technology to complement what we're already doing. It was more that it was an opportunity for a cost-effective acquisition that, you know, fit in to their puzzle.
Yeah.
And in the case of Elastifile, however, I think it was probably a combination of both. Like any of the cloud providers, File has been a bit of a conundrum.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they all have a basis in cloud-native DevOps philosophy of being very object storage-oriented. Right. And if you think back in the history of the public cloud providers and all of their explosive growth, it all began with S3. That was the first
2006.
Thing. 2006, yes. So AWS began there in terms of what they offered to the public, and that is still the foundation of storage in AWS, and there's Azure Blob, and GCP. Again, it's all object, object, object. It's the most scalable storage, but it's not the highest performance. And as they enter into more aggressive offerings around interesting workloads and applications that require file, they're looking for better ways to solve that problem that it's very difficult to address with object, if not impossible. So obviously they're interested in other alternatives. Elastifile is potentially an interesting path toward that. However, Elastifile does work over NAS protocol, so it supports, historically it supported NFS, and more recently they've added SMB. And neither one of those protocols can give you the same level of performance, for example, that we can, and it may not deliver all the performance that some of those workloads demand. The jury's out, right? It's still new.
Okay, let's come back to that in a second. And I know exactly what you mean, but from looking across the market of what the different vendors have offered in the public cloud from File, Amazon, for example, AWS had quite a weak set of features in EFS, I always thought. And then they couldn't really sort of work out, I don't think, again, I could be guessing, how to implement SMB. So they went down a different route and just said, we'll just deploy a Windows server and we'll expose SMB via a different set of devices. And now you've got two completely different systems.
It's not integrated.
Yes.
Yeah. But if you have a Windows native application, you can run it on a Windows host, as you point out.
Yeah.
And that's all well and good if what you're looking for is the feature content associated with Windows protocols. So that's checking one kind of box. But if you're looking for something at scale, it's just not going to work for you.
And I look at that and think, okay, you know, on the one hand, should I care how it's implemented because it's the cloud, and I'm doing air quotes for the recording so everybody knows, but because it's the cloud, you know, you sort of think, well, I shouldn't have to care as long as it delivers the features and the functionality I want. It doesn't matter what's going on behind the scenes with sticky tape and string and, you know, the things.
I couldn't agree more, by the way.
But personally, even though I think that's a reasonable assumption, it doesn't necessarily translate into a solution that will, over the long term, meet your requirements. It might in the short term, but as you said, scalability-wise, it is just not going to work.
The end user shouldn't care how it's implemented, but it does have to actually work.
Yeah.
So the challenge that they have is one of the areas that uses Windows applications quite a bit, you could be surprised or not, is life sciences. So okay. The genomics body of data in their data lake will be in a more of a Linux-oriented environment. However, the data scientists and researchers quite often have developed or worked with people who on their behalf have developed applications in a Windows context. So
right.
Even the Illumina scanners are SMB native. So it's an environment that's inherently multi-protocol. Therefore, if the people at Azure want to be successful with life sciences, of course they do, they're going to need to address both. And they're yep. in a pretty good position to do that, being Microsoft.
Absolutely.
Over on AWS, if they want to compete, they're going to have to also handle both sides. Well, if your both sides include one side that's running on Windows hosts and the other side that's running on Linux and is not integrated, I think that's going to be a challenge for them, and I'm sure they're well aware of this. They're very smart people.
And I'm sure they are too, and I would imagine that in the short term that was a solution that solved a problem for them whilst they decide how they move that forward. But it just seems to have taken them a long time to come up with something else in EFS. EFS has been around for a long time.
Well, EFS I don't think was the intended solution for those kinds of ambitious,
yes,
large-scale workloads.
Yeah.
No, it was kind of a placeholder, let's say. And then when you have things like their FSx managed
right.
solutions
exactly.
for
yeah.
with Lustre, but I think that's solving one kind of problem in that they administer these scale-out file systems, and then they put one of them on Windows and one of them using Lustre. Yeah, I think they're making steps in the right direction here. So that's what AWS is doing. We'll see what Azure is doing. Elastifile being added to the portfolio of solutions from GCP is also
yep.
interesting. Again, though, it's got its own NAS bottlenecks because of client-side limitations that you just can't get around. You can have fantastic service-side performance and capabilities, but the client can only do about a gigabit per second. Now that gigabyte per second. Now that sounds like plenty, but actually, in the larger scheme of things, it's not enough to keep a GPU busy.
Yeah, that's very true.
So that's our focus. I don't think we're myopic about it. I think we're recognizing and addressing a real market need. So we have customers who say, "Hey, we have a compute server." And our compute server doesn't just have one GPU that needs a gigabyte per second. It's got eight, right? Or we have other customers that say, we're big fans and we have just made a big investment. We didn't just buy one DGX-1 or one DGX-2. We bought eight of them or 10 of them or 12 of them. Each one of them needs tremendous quantities of I.O. that you can't feed over NFS or SMB.
So
that's where we come in.
So I think the interesting bit there is you've highlighted a very subtle implementation scenario there that possibly many people might not have picked up on. And I'll just wind us back to it so you can explain that, because I think it's actually pretty important. So if you look at, say, any of the existing cloud environments, and I'm just using cloud as an example, we could have talked about on-premises NAS or other sorts of solutions, but if you look at any of those environments, what we're saying is that, for example, Elastifile, even though it's cloud-native or it's deployed in the cloud, it will only expose data over standard networking protocols, whereas you're actually running client software on each of the hosts that's doing compute and talking to the storage directly across NVMe, which is a different model because you shifted the, if you like, the protocol or the I/O route down from the NFS protocol to something that you built yourself that talks between the servers.
I know
you do support NFS, by the way.
Yeah, we do, but it's not the way to get the best performance. But we do it for convenience of hosts that can't run our client. So the our client, by the way, simply presents what appears to be a local file system.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So you don't need to change your application.
But that's quite an important differentiation in the way that it's actually implemented. That might not be obvious to people.
It probably isn't, especially, I spent all those years at NetApp, and I'm still actually a fan. I think NetApp is a great solution if NFS will work for your purposes.
Yeah.
Because it simplifies your administration, and it does a good job within its capabilities. We do something different at a larger scale. Right, so that's the difference. Mm-hmm. Getting back to the cloud, though, and your original question about Elastifile, I think what it can do for Google is give them a better file-based offering than they've had in the past, but it'll only take them so far. I think at most it'll take them maybe 40% of the way on their journey toward providing what customers, because if you think about it, Google is a leader with their TPUs and with their research and so forth into AI and machine learning. Yeah. They are actually at the juncture between intense I/O requirements and the need for a higher performance file system. So with Elastifile, they're going to have to figure out a way to either break through that barrier. Or they're going to have to look for something else.
Absolutely, I was just going to say maybe that isn't the long term goal. Maybe this, as you said, was an opportunistic step for them to buy something that they could put into their cloud with no hardware requirement because it runs natively within existing virtual instances and so on. And then they could say, okay, now we can instantly tomorrow deliver file services, box ticked. Mm-hmm. Now we'll go off and give ourselves some breathing space to say, how are we going to deliver to that higher performance requirements of AI and other things?
And it probably addresses at least 50% of the market requirements. So, I'm not here to say that it was a mistake. It's probably a smart business move.
Neither am I. I'm just saying that it could be a very clever move to do that day one, whilst they give themselves time to think about how they're going to deliver to the requirements.
And considering what they paid for it, it's probably a brilliant stroke.
Yeah, absolutely. But you've raised a very interesting point that as the cloud matures and we see more intense workloads that need more I/O, it's just not going to be practical, A, to use the block solutions that are already there.
Yeah.
Certainly not the object solutions that are already there. Huh. And the file solutions are only like a halfway house to getting to that final set of requirements. So clearly there is work to do for everybody.
Right. Now, by the way, I should make it clear for your listeners, our software does run on-prem or on AWS.
Yes, that's true.
And we are in the process of working with the other cloud providers to get it available there as well. And the advantage of running it in the cloud, of course, is that someone else is administering the environment, which is a big offload in terms of your resources to support it and whatnot. But most of our customers are on-prem. I think 20% of our install base are on AWS today, and it works quite well in the cloud. So this is not a question of cloud versus on-prem, and there's no inhibitor to a cloud-based deployment that would prevent them from enjoying similar benefits. Historically, there used to be an issue where in the cloud you couldn't get 100 gigabit Ethernet, but now you can. So, even that limitation, that constraint is gone.
Yeah, okay. So, that is an interesting scenario that we are seeing quite an interesting evolution with the types of workloads that the cloud is processing and how it's having to deal with what is becoming ever increasingly a focus on machine learning, AI, and just processing very large amounts of data. I guess I'm thinking of what we've seen at the event this week and thinking things like E8 as an acquisition might well have been both an IP purchase and obviously the guys are very, very talented as another step forward for Amazon to look at to see how they're going to solve some of the network bandwidth bottlenecks that they've got within their environment to deliver these requirements. So it's clear that there's a challenge for the cloud providers that they're looking to try and address one way or another.
I couldn't agree more. I think the journey is still in the earliest stages, really. As amazing as the capabilities of the cloud or even what you can deploy on-prem may seem today, it's only getting faster and better. So what we can do with flash is pretty impressive. When you get to the point where you've got petabytes of flash, that may seem like a lot, but we have customers that have, 100 petabytes of data, and they like the fact that we create a unified namespace where most of it's sitting in more affordable hard disks that's actually managed by an object store, but we make it look like it's all on the same file system. And then we can also do this snap-to-object thing, which is pretty cool, where we do a special type of snapshot into the object store. Now, that's portable. That snap-to-object image can then be moved around, right, between clouds or between data centers, and then you can rehydrate it somewhere else for processing. That is actually a very cloud-like concept.
Yeah, definitely.
And it should be, over time, the kind of thing that the cloud providers look for. I mean, I don't know who else is going to be able to do anything even like that, because it's so endemic to our fundamental design. But in the meantime, it's available from us.
Okay, so one final question as we wrap up then. We talked briefly before we actually dug down into this and started recording about PCI and PCIe and PCI Express, to use as many acronyms as I can possibly get in there, about how that's evolving and where it's heading towards. Now, we talked about PCIe 5, PCI Express 6. What do you see as the constraints today? And do you think those things like the improved performance of things like PCI will make a radical change in the industry?
Well, I think everyone would agree that Gen 4 is late, and not only is it twice the bandwidth of Gen 3, which would be nice to have, mm-hmm. but it has twice as many lanes.
Right.
And when you're designing these server class systems, the first constraint that you bump up against is lanes.
Okay.
Because you need a bunch of lanes for your high performance networks. And then you need twice as many if you're going to have redundant networks, which of course you want to have. And then you need a bunch of lanes to have plenty of bandwidth to your NVMe devices. And then before you know it, you're putting everything behind a PCI switch. And then you better have good PCI switch in order to have enough bandwidth.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Then you think, oh, I better have two PCI switches. And you know, once you've scaled out the hardware that much, it's not very inexpensive commodity hardware anymore, is it?
Yeah.
You know, right. And then if you look at the promise of what EPYC seemed to be offering from AMD.
I was just going to mention that, yeah.
Right, it was such a beautiful thing, and then it turned out to have all these subtle NUMA bugs because it turned out to be a hard problem. Well, I would love to see, I know the whole industry is kind of holding its breath, I would love to see us get over the hump and have, you know, Gen 4 and then mm-hmm. as soon as possible Gen 5 out there for everyone to take full advantage of.
Okay, brilliant. If people would like to follow you and understand more what you do for the company, just, you know, listen to what you have to say about the industry, where can they follow you?
Well, I do blog a bunch, and I'm trying to record more things. That's all available through the weka.io website. And I'm an old guy, but I am learning to tweet more.
Okay, brilliant.
So my Twitter handle is @_AndyWatson.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, thanks, Andy. I'll make sure that we put all of that in the show notes to save people having to try and remember it. But for now, thanks very much for your time, and look forward to catching up soon.
Thank you very much, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter @StorageUnpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.